The Snake River Killer podcast is tracking multiple active and cold cases. This investigation is happening in real time. All individuals named and unnamed in this podcast are innocent until proven guilty by a court of law. This episode contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Where is Christina White?
Who is the suspect?
Detective Jackie Nichols believes there may be a connection between Christina White's disappearance, the murders of Christina Nelson and Brandy Miller, as well as the disappearance of Stephen Pearsall.
All suspected to have fallen victim at the hands of another. Law enforcement made a critical discovery shortly after the murders of Miller and Nelson.
The man that was working in the theater that night lived at the home where Christina White disappeared from.
He was very odd himself. He was more creepy, scary odd.
Opposed to the drawdown, so I agree with that, being suspicious.
She was on the porch and she waved goodbye, and that was the last time I saw her.
Hey everybody, Brandon Trant here. On behalf of the Snake River Killer podcast and the entire team, I want to thank you for your loyalty after our hiatus. The response we've received after returning has been overwhelming and, well, encouraging. So thank you, and keep tuning in, because there's a lot more to come. There's something else here at the top of the show that I want to apprise you of. This was brought to my attention last spring, and I thought it would be worth sharing. On the afternoon of May 15th, 2023, I received a message from a couple in Seattle, Bells and Danette, who happened to be listeners of the show. They wanted to share some photographs of some items they had found at a Goodwill thrift store they had worked at. About a year and a half ago, Bells was processing donated musical instruments when he came across a clarinet case. Now, typically, he would open these kinds of cases, inspect the instrument, and then process it accordingly. But when he popped open the clasps on this case, he couldn't have ever imagined what he was about to find. The clarinet case was filled with homemade knives and what appeared to be small swords. But the most bizarre part is that the inside of the case had been custom made to accommodate the knives and swords. When they forwarded the photographs, I have to say I was pretty shocked, to be honest. But what exactly did these knives have to do with these cases? Why contact me? Then I got to thinking about it and how there could be at least a remote possibility that there was a connection. But I needed to know more. So over the ensuing months, I tried to get a call lined up with Danette and Bells, but our schedules just didn't work out. Until recently, that is.
I work at Goodwill. I see all the musical instruments. I go through them and see which ones goes to the store and which ones we sell online. The cheapest ones, we send them to the stores, and the expensive ones, we sell them online. So I have to check all the instruments that comes from donations here in Washington. And I was going through all these cases, tons of trumpets and guitars and clarinets. So this was kind of like an old clarinet case. So I opened it up and it was just inside. It was kind of like custom made with plaster, so you can fit all the knives in it. It was just full of knives, like custom made knives. They had a brand, but they were cut. Like somebody took a lot of time to customize these knives for a purpose. I don't think that someone can take that much effort to customize something for fishing when you can buy something for fishing, right? They were pretty much aggressive knives. The handle was kind of like for stabbing, you know, you grab it and it was
for certain movements.
Yeah,
it was certain movements.
Like,
it's not for like fishing. But the thing is that when they put them back in, it was like the inside was custom for the knives to be put in a certain way, and only if you knew how to put them in that way, was really hard to close
it. I couldn't close it anymore again because I couldn't find a way to for all the knives to fit again. So It even had like a little hole. So the larger knife, which is was kind of like a saw, you can put it like inside that little hole, and on the edges it has just little holes so the knives can
to accommodate them.
But I can put them back together again. Like I can figure it out to close it on again.
So it's almost like a puzzle the way that they fit into the case.
Exactly. Yeah.
And somebody did this plaster specifically to hold this set of knives, right?
Yeah, somebody took the time to actually like put these knives in it and make them fit to carry it. Because, I mean, that's another thing. Like, it's easier to carry a clarinet case than carrying, you know, like how chefs carry knives and stuff like that.
Also, this clarinet case, it looked old, like from the 20s.
Okay, so it's not a new one.
No.
So it could have been around in the 1980s. Well, obviously, it probably was around in the 1980s. Now, you guys are located where again? And you can just give a general...
We're in Seattle, and the Goodwill is the main area where that arrived to is the Dearborn location.
We get all the donations from all the stores, like Bellingham and all the Washington area. We get the donations.
Okay, so you're kind of like the hub where everything comes in, and then you send everything out.
Exactly.
Okay. So that is interesting for a couple of reasons, and it gets me to a question that I want to ask both of you, and maybe Danette, because she reached out. Why did you reach out to me on the Snake River Killer? What was it about this find that made you think, Lance Voss, Snake River Killer, what were the connections that you were drawing? Because I'm interested in this myself, but I was curious about what your thought process was.
Well, first of all, in the state of Washington, there's a lot of things going on in serial killers and all that. So keeping an eye out on certain objects that arrive to these donation centers is definitely a must. I don't know, but it was kind of like a vibe. And also the way that I've seen how Lance Voss or how this person has been acting or murdering, you know, I saw red flags about it. And those knives arrived to donation, and I thought they were weird, and I kept the pictures and I kept showing them to people like, hey, what do you think about this? And everybody was like, oh, you know, like I would ask around people like that do fishing, you know, and like that know of maybe chefs, you know, that know how to fillet and stuff like that. And they were like, no, this is something really strange. So for me, after hearing your podcast, I kind of made a connection and was like, well, it's in the state of Washington, and we do get a lot of weird things in Goodwill. So, I mean, more than anything, to make a connection, because I don't want to make assumptions on something that I'm not, like, for sure. But I think that it is kind of strange, and in general, it's good to keep an eye out to those kinds of objects, because it might be potential evidence, you know, to solve a crime or to solve or give a victim some justice. I don't know. That's my point of view on it.
No, and I think you're both absolutely right. Whether it's related to these cases or other cases, right, I think it's alarming. And I think that I would have definitely thought, Bells, if I were you and opened this thing up, I mean, you must have just been like, what on earth is this all about? Like, that's the last thing you would have probably expected, popping open a case like that.
Exactly. Yeah, it was scary.
I mean, and also, like, you're doing music, you know, it's like finding, I don't know, like human hair. And like, it happened to me at jewelry, you know, you find these weird things. It's like, this isn't supposed to be here, but finding knives in a clarinet case.
Right.
The donations of music instruments is kind of like not very expected.
What we do know about Lance Voss is during the early to mid 1980s, when a lot of these cases were active, he was driving a van for a store called Music City, delivering musical instruments around the Pacific Northwest.
I just got chills. Wow.
So there are a couple of things that really struck me in my conversation with Bells and Danette. The first thing was the level of customization that went into the clarinet case. I knew from their initial email that the case was customized, but I didn't know that someone had gone to the lengths of using plaster for the customization. Second, and perhaps most interesting, at least to me, is how the knives apparently had to be put back in exactly the same way, otherwise the case wouldn't close again. as if the clarinet case and the knives were a puzzle that could only be solved by their creator. Okay, so what do we know for certain when it comes to these knives and the clarinet case? Well, we know that the case is old, predating the 1980s. We also know that in the People Investigates documentary on these cases, filmmaker and LC Valley native Brian Fuller said, quote, "During this time of the murder of Kristen David, I remember distinctively preparing for one of our campouts, and Lance, the assistant scoutmaster, brought in weapons, knives and swords he made out of industrial steel, and I remember distinctively him throwing up a cantaloupe and cutting it in half in midair," end quote. So that is one thing, that Lance custom made his own knives and swords out of industrial steel, swords and knives that are likely very similar to the ones found in the clarinet case. We also know that he drove a van for Music City, delivering instruments around the Northwest. And we know that the Dearborn Goodwill facility is a hub in the Seattle area that receives donations from all around the state. We also know that in her interview with law enforcement, Dolores Brereton, Lance's one-time insurance agent, said that when she asked him where he was from, he didn't say Chicago. Instead, he said he spent time in Seattle and on the Green River. So those are the known knowns. What are the unknowns? Well, for me, the biggest unknown happens to be the biggest hurdle and stumbling block in connecting these knives and case in any way to what we know about Lance himself. And that is, where are the knives now? Curious, I reached out to two supervisors at the Dearborn facility to see if I could find any information or trace as to what became of them. One of them wrote back, quote, "The donation that you speak of would have been set aside with other weapons received, such as guns or other swords, etc. These items are collected by our loss prevention team each month, who then coordinate a day and time for the Seattle Police Department to collect them. I can only assume what happens from there, but I would imagine that the SPD has a process to determine if any of these items tie into any active investigations," end quote. Given what this manager said, it looks like we need to check in with the Seattle Police Department to try to determine which precinct or unit is tasked with this particular process and to see if they have any record of this donation. Given how onerous that process may be, though, I have to weigh the potential outcomes against the time it would take to further investigate. If this is something any of our listeners would like to take on, please message me and let me know. Hopefully we can work something out. The reason I'm undecided on the question of pursuing this lead ties into another hurdle of connecting them to Lance. And for me, it's kind of a big hurdle. And that hurdle is this. If the knives and swords did belong to Lance, why did he get rid of them? How did they end up in the Goodwill ecosystem? I just can't see a plausible explanation for why he would have parted ways with them and in such a manner that they would have ended up in some donation pile. If, for instance, he felt the law enforcement was breathing down his neck and he needed to get rid of his arsenal of knives, why not drop them in a river or go out into the woods and bury them or burn them or chuck them into a dumpster in another town? I just can't imagine a plausible scenario that would move the case of knives from Lance himself into a situation where they would be donated years and years later. On the other hand, I suppose there could be a scenario in which Lance, in a pre-DNA forensic world, might have dumped them into, say, the bed of somebody's truck as a way of casting blame away from him and suspicion on somebody else if he was feeling the heat. I suppose that's possible. It just seems to be a stretch. But until we can verify the ultimate fate of these swords and knives with the police department in Seattle, there just remain more questions than answers. All that said, if Lance didn't have a musical background, and if he hadn't driven a van for Music City all around the Pacific Northwest, and if Brian Fuller hadn't recalled Voss's arsenal of homemade knives at scout camp, I probably wouldn't have even mentioned them on the show. But because of those points of connection, I did think it was important to invite Danette and Bells onto the podcast, and for their time, I thank them. Someone else I've been wanting to invite on the show is retired FBI agent and profiler Julia Cowley. And recently, I was honored to have the chance to interview her. We talked about a range of topics surrounding these cases, and while she didn't weigh in on Lance's culpability, of course, she did really impress upon me the importance of victimology. That is, the science of studying everything about the victims. And by everything, she means everything. But she also provided what I found to be a very important perspective when it comes to one of these cases in particular, and that is the case of Kristen David. And finally, one of the other things we talked about was the importance of circumstantial evidence. Because prior to talking with Julia, I was sort of haunted by the overwhelming and nagging fear that everything her team was finding may not matter and may not move the needle at all. But she spoke to that fear, and more importantly, she allayed that fear.
My name is Julia Cowley. I'm a retired FBI agent and profiler. I was 22 years in the FBI, and prior to that, I was a forensic scientist, and I worked for the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. And in that role, I was a member of the violent crime response team, and would go to homicide scenes and process and collect evidence and bring it back to laboratories. That was part of my duties in the crime lab.
Have you had experience then with serial killers in that line of work?
I have. Mostly my experience with serial killings has been with my experience with the FBI's behavioral analysis unit. And okay. I have worked on cases, and I have also been the lead profiler on serial murder cases.
So the famous BAU.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. That's impressive. So I guess given your background in those capacities, I'm wondering if often, particularly on this show, it's easy to get kind of buried in the minutiae and the details, but it's always useful to kind of come back out to 30,000 feet and maybe kind of refresh our understanding of where we are in the current science of how investigators are looking at serial murder. I mean, we just had the Long Island serial killer. A suspect has been, I think, identified in those cases. And I'm just wondering from your experience, are there certain markers across serial killers that are common? You know, I've read in places where it was believed that bedwetting, animal cruelty, and arson were some markers common to serial killers. And then I've read recently that maybe the thinking might have changed on some of that. And I'm just wondering from your point of view, is each case so unique that you can't extrapolate any kind of, you know, overarching markers, or are there rhyming traits or characteristics across some cases?
I think early on, some of the early research suggested that many of the serial killers that they were looking at had some sort of abuse in their past, and abuse can lead to certain behaviors and such as maybe bedwetting. I think fire starting was another warning sign. And certainly if a child is abused, they may act out in those ways, and they may act out in violent ways. They also may internalize things. So I think everyone deals differently with abuse. But I think early on, that was some of what the research suggested. Now, it's been my experience, though, that that's not always the case. One of my colleagues and mentors in the unit has said, if you've seen one serial killer, you've seen one serial killer, and you can't apply these behaviors or these certain characteristics to serial killers across the board.
One of the other things that we often talk about, and I think it would behoove us to kind of, again, refresh ourselves. We hear the term victimology thrown around a lot, and my word nerd self knows that that probably means the study of victims. But beyond that, somebody in your background in the FBI or in a profiler, when you're looking at victims, what are some of the things that you're looking for? I mean, can you speak to that at all? When we talk about victimology, what does that really entail?
Victimology, bottom line, is a complete picture of a crime victim. Every detail that we can find out about that victim is really important, because what we're trying to do is, one of the things we're trying to do is to assess where their risks are. Are they doing anything? Are they coming into contact with people? Are they living a lifestyle, you know, involved in criminal activities that may make them more at risk? And it's really important to understand. Or are they lower risk? Are they living, you know, very cautiously and abiding by the laws and the rules? And so that makes them lower risk. So I think that's one of the things we're trying to determine when we look at victimology. It's extremely important in cases because, I mean, I truly believe the more you can know about your victim, the more you'll know about your offender. So, and I think sometimes victimology gets overlooked because we have to ask these very sensitive questions about victims, and we don't want to come across as if we're victim blaming. It's just more about understanding that victim. And in some of the cases, victimology, there's, you know, if you have many victims, like a series, victimology may be looking at it collectively. And sometimes you're looking at, you know, just very specific, that one individual, because you have one crime and you're trying to determine, okay, where in their life were they at risk? And it can be key in some cases, determining perhaps motivation of the offender.
You had mentioned in an email to me linkage analysis, and I don't know if I've heard that term before, and maybe I can guess at that, but can you explain that to us?
It's one of the things that we look at in terms of you have a series of crimes, trying to determine if they're linked in some way to a common offender. And obviously the best way to link a crime together or crimes, multiple crimes together is through scientific evidence, DNA. That's the best way. Being a former forensic scientist, you know, the hard science trumps everything.
Yep.
But if you don't have that, you're looking for behavior. For example, if you don't have DNA in scenes, you're looking at, okay, were there common behavioral indicators that we can say, yes, this is a common offender. Some cases are easier than others to do that. You know, I've looked at cases where it is very clear there are very specific, maybe ritualistic behaviors going on in a scene that an offender does each and every time. And it's much easier to say, yeah, these are so unique, we can link these together. Sometimes the MOs change, the ritualistic behavior isn't as obvious, and it's very difficult to link cases together behaviorally or geographically if they're far apart. Sometimes if you have a cluster of cases that are close together, even if the MOs and ritual behavior is different, you can kind of link them together because they're close together. So maybe that's not definitive, but you can say maybe we should be looking at these as a series. But if you have a case where, you know, one's in, you know, California, the other one's in New York, it makes it more difficult. Another thing that can make it very difficult is just when you don't actually have a crime scene or a victim goes missing. That can be difficult because sometimes if a victim goes missing, you don't even know if you have a crime. You may have an accident. You may have someone who's decided to leave on their own accord. And so again, looking at victimology, looking at the history of that person and trying to show that they ceased to live. And there's no evidence of that. And that's how you have to kind of look at some of these missing person cases to determine, you know, are they alive somewhere? Did they disappear on their own? Or did they meet with foul play? You know, so, you know, looking at it, kind of changing the mindset, like, can we show that this person ceases to live?
In the cases that we're kind of looking at down in the Lewis-Clarkston Valley along the Idaho-Washington border, you're dealing with very small towns, a very big geography, but low density population where violent crime happens, but is not common, wasn't common back in the late 70s and 80s. And then all of a sudden you have the spate of disappearances and murders. And the law enforcement that I've spoken with who've worked on the cases do believe that most, if not all of them, are linked. And they believe, though, you know, there's frustration there because there's no hard scientific evidence to point to their person of interest. And so I'm wondering, okay, you have proximity, you have kind of a remote geographical location, low density of population, low occurrence of violent crime, but you don't have really any DNA evidence. Can cases proceed without that hard evidence? Like just working circumstantial evidence, can that ultimately lead to that kind of hard data that forensic scientists would be looking for?
I mean, these cases are extremely difficult because they happened a long time ago, mm-hmm. and there's not a lot of physical evidence that we know of. I would think with advances in technology, I don't rule anything out anymore. So going back and going over and saying, okay, what do we have that we can test at this time and see if we can develop any kind of physical evidence that may identify somebody. So I think that's promising. Cases can be made on circumstantial evidence, and they are made on circumstantial evidence. In these particular cases that you're referring to, I don't know what all the evidence that they do have. I'm sure that there is more evidence than we know of, mm-hmm. but certainly there's not enough to make an arrest. They don't feel that they have enough to make an arrest at this point. But that circumstantial evidence is extremely important. You know, timelines and behavior and some of those things that seem very coincidental. And all this stuff can add up, and then you get a piece of physical evidence
right.
that may, you know, identify or link to a particular person. And then you can put together a very strong case with that circumstantial evidence. I mean, circumstantial evidence can be really good evidence, can be in cases are made entirely on circumstantial evidence.
There is one case in the LC Valley where Kristen David, 1981, she was dismembered and her remains were found in black plastic bags in the Snake River. And there's kind of two camps of thought. One is that the mode there is so radically different from the two bodies found in 1984 from the Civic Theater that it feels like there's maybe no connection there. But then the other camp says, well, we don't know what happened to, like you said, the missing people like Christina White, who vanished in 1979, the 12-year-old girl, or Stephen Pearsall, who's 35, who vanished the same night as the two girls from the Civic Theater. I mean, maybe he could be looked at as the perpetrator. You'd kind of have to keep your mind open a little bit, but there's no evidence that he's surfaced on the radar, but that doesn't mean he's still out there. It doesn't mean Christina White's still out there. By the same token, it doesn't mean that if they fell victim to foul play, that maybe their remains were disposed of in a similar fashion. So I guess the question of MOs changing, again, does it come back to that? It's very specific to the perpetrator. It just depends, maybe. I don't know.
That's right. It could be specific to that particular incident. It could be how the victim reacted. It could be the relationship that the offender has with the victim. I don't think you can rule out something just because the MOs are different, or because maybe victim selection is different or disposal is different. I just don't think you can say, okay, it's not connected at all. So it's very challenging, again, when you don't actually have the bodies of other victims, so you don't know. But absolutely, MO can change. It does change. It can change based on just learning and getting better or learning from mistakes. There's all sorts of reasons that an MO can change. And I have seen serial offenders change up their MOs entirely that people don't even connect them together. Mm. And then I've seen others that, like I said, are extremely consistent. So I would never rule just, you know, especially, you know, in a, like you described the area, confined small area, low crime rate. I believe the victims were all probably fairly low risk. I don't know their victimology. You know, there's just not a lot of victimology out there about them that I know of, but I don't think you can completely rule out that it's not connected just because perhaps a disposal method didn't match a couple others, because we don't have a complete picture.
Right.
So I just wouldn't rule it out.
So in addition to the importance of victimology and the notion of not ruling Kristen David out of these cases, Julia did underscore the importance of circumstantial evidence when it comes to the broader view of what we know. And that is why I think Lance's so-called lesson plan, especially those 38 words, are so important, and why I feel they bear even more scrutiny. And this exercise was something I definitely knew I wanted to run by Paul. Like Kathy and me, Paul is not only a professional writer, but he has experience teaching writing.
Several episodes ago, we talked about when his various roles in theater, and we kind of went back and forth a little bit on the Arsenic and Old Lace, where he literally played a serial killer in that play. Was that a one-off? Did it really say anything? Was he trying to have it both ways, kind of act the part and sort of wink at the audience in a dark way? Or was it just all much ado about nothing? And I'm wondering just kind of what's your take?
Well, I've got a few thoughts. I kind of saw it almost as another example, similar to being in Arsenic and Old Lace, of kind of being bold, I guess, and kind of giving himself up a little bit, revealing a little bit of himself, almost as if to say, for those of you who do know me, I've been accused of being a serial killer. Here's where I'm going to talk about being a serial killer, similar to being an Arsenic and Old Lace, right? I'm in the public eye. I've got people looking at me suspiciously. So here's where I'm going to just say something outright that would almost lend to that suspicion, but under the guise of acceptance, I guess, in this case, a lesson plan. In the case of Arsenic and Old Lace, a theater production. I think it was the director who said, you know, people are going to believe you or not, so you might as well do what you want to do, which maybe inadvertently inspired him to be so bold in some of these instances.
It's interesting, though, to me, and maybe you thought a little bit about this. So on the one hand, I'm thinking of the Notes Plus writing exercise as being put in a fairly niche, safe space. Yet Arsenic and Old Lace was opposite of that. It's full-on production on a stage in front of the community that he's living in under this cloud of suspicion. So it's almost diametrically opposite.
Yeah. And this is something that maybe Marianne could speak to, but I think it's almost any opportunity to flaunt it a little bit, right? I mean, if you look at, if we're going to go with the classifieds, right? The classifieds are public, but they're not as blatant as being on stage, of course, but then not as public and out front as writing a lesson plan that talks about a serial killer either. But I think it's almost taking any opportunity to say, look how smart I am. I think it's almost might even be more enjoyable if it is kind of under the radar. I can see either way, right? That it's either a safe space or it's flying under the radar, or in his mind, it's actually kind of out there. But I think regardless, if this is a person who likes to taunt a little bit,
yeah,
and to say without saying what happened, yeah, I think he's going to take a lot of opportunities to do that. And this might be one of them.
Yeah, I think that your point of any opportunity is, I think, pretty spot on. From what we've gleaned from some examples that we have in his past, these are his own words. You know, so in Arsenic and Old Lace, it's not his words. He's just acting a part, but this is different. This is him using word choices and not using the word victims, but using the word weaker opponents, you know, that kind of thing. So Notes Plus is published by the National English Teachers Association.
Was he studying to be a teacher?
That part is a little bit fuzzy to me. The only evidence we have that he was ever involved in any sort of teaching environment was with music down in the valley. There's no evidence that he actually ever taught English or even student taught English.
Yeah. I mean, it starts right off. The purpose of this activity is to give students practice in using language to illustrate different points of view or differing viewpoints. So that could be a number of classes, humanities, that could be. But I mean, as a former language arts teacher, that tells me it sounds like a language arts lesson, right?
Yeah. I was going to say, as a former English teacher, English professor myself, and one who taught comp, this is something that would be a very plug and play kind of activity or writing exercise, a lesson plan. Yeah.
Right. Well, and that's what jumped out at me is that I could envision myself doing something like this in one of my classes. Mm-hmm. This was not too terribly far out to me to see myself giving a similar lesson. What makes it more interesting is when you start layering on the other allegations about Lance, then you kind of look at it with a little bit of a different eye.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, the language is very peculiar, and not knowing if it was for language arts. You know, I think the more traditional terms versus favorable or unfavorable, might be very simply protagonist, antagonist. I think you mentioned, even just the juxtaposition of good and evil. But he chooses favorable and unfavorable. And as I think you pointed out, even the language for the serial killer is favorable. It's deadly strength, easily crushing the life, the weaker opponents, the steely eyes, the helpless prey. Just a few of the things that, these are things that the students are supposed to be writing in an unfavorable light. And it's glorifying.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's interesting that he writes this as if he has done it with students.
Yeah.
Where? Right?
Right.
To say, and not only say, but italicize, students never recognize my picture of Taft, and that is interesting that it's his picture, that they never recognize.
Never being
it implies that he's done it. He's given this activity, as he calls it, numerous times.
There's one other part that I would point your attention to that I found really interesting. It's when he's talking about a picture of any person will be fine, or a place or an object, but people are easiest. And then he writes something to the effect of, the person in the photograph should not be identifiable to the student, since knowing something about their quote true nature may
interfere with the full descriptive creativity.
Yeah. True nature. Like, that's pretty loaded right there. Like, who knows the true nature of anybody? Right.
All right.
Do we know the true nature of William Howard Taft? I mean, we know he's a president, but is that his true nature? I mean, it's almost like, when we talk about duality of personality here, is Lance cueing out to his own true nature? Like, if we knew something of his true nature, like, there's the persona and then there's the true nature.
And the people are easiest is weird. I could imagine some examples of where you may do this with a place or an object to give a favorable or unfavorable.
Yeah, I mean...
It does seem, but and not people work best. People are easiest.
So, okay, thought experiment. Here's a picture of an older hospital. Favorable light. Many people have gone here and have had healthy children and have been healed and have turned over new leaves and have walked out, wonderful. And then you could have also now imagine this as a sanitarium where abuses run rampant, right? You know, you could do that with a place.
Right. And then that's what I was thinking too, a haunted, someplace haunted. Again, that's where my brain goes, but
yeah. You could do that with anything. I mean, Stephen King does that with a dog, Cujo, a loving dog. What if that dog isn't loving, a car, Christine. It's just a car. It's an American icon. Well, what if the car turns against you? Like, you can do that with objects. But his phrasing, you're right, people are easiest, is just kind of weird. It's one of those off-register things again.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy.
So given what Paul and I discussed, I want to circle back to something else in the exercise. Voss writes, quote, steely eyes like those of some hostile carnivore, staring out from the dimness of the run-down deck, lying in wait for helpless prey, end quote. Now, ostensibly, he is describing Taft still. Or is he? I think the entire second half of the assignment is Lance describing Lance, which I think goes without saying at this point. And recall, too, how we have talked about Lance's eyes as early as episode 4 of this show.
now that I look at it and think about it, he kind of had kind of crazy eyes. But he was such a chameleon when it came to his persona.
I mean, to me, the eyes really stick out here. Why? Well, because Lance chose to focus on them, for one thing. I mean, we've talked on this show before about the eyes of serial killers and how when you look at Ted Bundy or Dennis Rader or John Wayne Gacy, there's an animal flatness to the stare, a flinty void where essential humanness ought to reside. And it turns out that this common held notion that serial killers or quote-quote evil people generally have eyes that are off somehow, that isn't just folklore. In 2019, Matthew J. Sharps and Megan Herrera published a paper titled The Eyes Really Do Have It, Attribution of Character in the Eyes of Killers. This was published in the Journal of Police and Criminology. The paper details their findings from two experiments that isolated the eyes of nonviolent people and the eyes of known serial killers. The researchers had two sets of respondents view these different sets of eyes, judging them on three criteria: trustworthiness, likability, and general goodness. In both cases, the respondents overwhelmingly identified the isolated eyes of killers, whose identities were unknown to the respondents, as deeply lacking in these three categories. Moreover, these findings, the authors note, are, quote, consistent with current evolutionary and cognitive theory and may highlight the importance of defendants by witnesses and jurors in criminal proceedings, end quote. In other words, there's some science to back up our conception that there is some definite weirdness going on in the eyes of known convicted killers and serial killers. And these findings may give us another way of not only looking at Lance, but it may help us understand why Lance may have spent so much time describing the eyes in this exercise. Is it possible, in other words, that Lance himself knows that his eyes are, in the words of his friend Dave Blaskowitz, kinda crazy? My friend and fellow podcaster, Jason Blair, calls these moments of overindulgence or instances of extra attention gratuitousness. When Lance is being gratuitous with his language, in other words, we ought to be paying attention because he's trying to tell us something, and I think the eyes are a case in point. At the time, the eyes in Lance's description are linked to the shady veranda slash sheltered porch slash rundown deck. Also this, it's from the dimness of the rundown deck, after all, that these steely and hostile carnivore eyes are staring. And to that point, what do we make of the shady veranda that became a sheltered porch and is now suddenly a rundown deck? Why is this structure slowly deteriorating? Why, like the fictional toys, is it now damaged? This is something Kathy raised in the last episode, and it's something Sam and I discussed because, as you will recall, it was something of a rundown porch or deck on which Christina White was last seen. So this could be significant.
One of the things that you really keyed in on was this business of the shady veranda turning into the sheltered porch, turning into a rundown deck.
I'm like, what if it's not a symbolic thing? Like, what if he actually has like bodies buried underneath a porch somewhere?
Or what if he nabbed victims from one house as a shady veranda, one was a sheltered porch, one was a rundown deck? I'm wondering if these porches, decks, verandas are literally crime scenes.
The house that Christina was taken from had a porch. The other one had a porch. And it made me think of the classified ads. So with the classified ads, we have the March 3rd Lost ad. So Lost March 3rd in the Assotin area, Brown Husky. This is kind of the ad that started it all, right?
Yes.
This one has two phone numbers. 758-9422. 243-4284. 243-4284 goes to the 503, is it 2nd Street?
Yeah.
Right? That's that phone number. What time was she taken?
Late afternoon and...
So one could argue the evening on the weekend. Is he trying to say, this is where I took her and this is where, you know, this is where I took her from and this... So if we find out where that 758 number goes to, are we going to find out where she is? Same thing with these ones. Free to good home, 243-4284, Assotin. Does that mean whatever happened in that home? Afghan bitch, 243-4284 or 243-4763. Do you know what I'm saying? Because some of them have two, some of them have one. And we don't see that 758 number again until we get the Gran Torino ad, which, one thing, Ford Gran Torino, he puts a Grand Torino.
Okay, I just want to jump in here real quick to interject a little bit of context. Sam is referring to several phone numbers we believe are connected to Lance and that show up in several classified ads in the Lewiston Morning Tribune newspaper. And some of those ads came from Lance himself when he was selling real estate. Now, you can find a list of these phone numbers on our website, snakeriverkiller.com. There, you can also find the classified ads that we haven't really dug into on the show, but that Sam is referencing here. These ads reflect a lot of the themes we've already seen on the show, running the gamut from cars to musical instruments to real estate properties. And it's on this last point of properties that I want to focus, as it may have something to do with the shady veranda, sheltered porch, and rundown deck that Lance went to pains to describe in his Notes Plus lesson plan. Sam's fundamental question, I think, is a good one. Is there any connective tissue between these very descriptive property features and the various classified ads that Lance placed in the newspaper? Or more broadly, should we be looking at any other properties connected to Lance that have or at one time had a shady veranda, a sheltered porch, or a rundown deck? Again, as mentioned, we need only to look at the last place Christina White was seen as a potential clue, the covered porch of the 503 Second Street house in which Lance was living at the time. But again, what about any other properties that might be connected to him? So it turns out that there is an interesting property that keeps cropping up on the radar, and it's one that Sam has spent some time looking into. And so we talked a little bit about that.
That house that I was obsessed with is that 1145 12th Street in Clarkston. 758-1589 is the phone number to call. First ad is roomy 5-bedroom, 4 up and 1 down. All remodeled, new carpeting, big kitchen, large yard. 758-1589, 1145 12th Street, Clarkston. And then the second one we get, which is posted almost a year later.
And just to follow up for context, the first ad was placed in December of 1982, and the second ad was placed in April of 1983, or just 4 months later.
Large 5-bedroom, 1 bath, basement, garden, wood heat. No house pets.
As it stands now, the house at 1145 12th Street in Clarkston does not appear to have anything resembling a veranda, porch, or deck, rundown or otherwise. But it's an old house, so I suppose it's conceivable that it may have had a porch at some time in its history. I just don't know. Finally, just a couple of parting thoughts here. First, these structural features that Lance mentions in the lesson plan, I think they're significant. Now, why do I think that? Because he's putting effort in for readers to pay attention to them. He's flagging them, in other words. So we need to bear that in mind. Second, in the first ad placed in December of 1982, or 3 months after Brandy and Christina were killed and Stephen vanished, the ad mentions the remodel and, specifically, new carpeting. Of course, in the business of rentals in a college town, this kind of property improvement is as routine as the sunrise. But in the world of crime, and especially murder, new carpeting is often a red flag, and for good reason. In other words, did Lance have access to a property during and in the wake of the Civic 3 tragedies? It's possible, and this property may have been one of them. It's also conceivable, given the timeline, that this property may have been under construction in September of 1982, and that by December, the renovations had been complete, hence the vacancy ad in the newspaper. Also this, it is curious, at least to me, that 4 months later, in April of 1983, the ad is emphatic about no house pets. Again, this seems plausible and completely innocent. However, if I were a landlord and I had installed new carpeting in a remodeled property, I think I would have stipulated from the outset that house pets wouldn't be allowed. On the other hand, I could see how a landlord might be lenient at first and allow house pets, only to discover that the tenants were terrible and the pets nearly destroyed the new carpeting. So, you make a new rule, no house pets. But could it also be possible that the tenants had dogs who kept pawing at the carpet? Dogs that were drawn, perhaps, to something beneath that carpeting, to something in the floorboards. Hard to say. And listen, that could be totally my imagination running wild here, because this is a lot of speculation, but at the same time, maybe it's something that we just put on the back burner for further consideration. For the time being, I want to come back to Lance's lesson plan itself, and I want to focus on some passages beyond the veranda, porch, and deck. I want to turn our focus on how he imagined or fantasized that the activity would be used in the classroom. For instance, and Paul and I discussed this earlier, Voss writes, quote, "This exercise is intended to be upgraded, the results shared with the class by means of students reading their descriptions aloud. The exercise can be used more than once, with a different picture each time, to give everyone a chance to get in the spirit of producing the most fanciful descriptions possible," end quote. Now, I want you to think about that passage for a good long minute, because Lance is, I believe, revealing far more than what appears on the surface. First, Voss is wanting students, children really, across the country to write descriptions of a mass murderer. Kids that could, again, range in age from 12, like Christina White, to 17, like Antoinette Nino. But I want to zero in on the last part of the first sentence. Specifically, he's wanting them to read their passages of a mass murderer aloud in class. And what is the act of reading creative prose aloud in front of an audience but a performative act, something not unlike a theatrical monologue? Next, pay attention to the final set of suggestions / instructions. Voss writes, quote, "This exercise can be used more than once, with a different picture each time," end quote. Now, I can tell you, as someone who has prepared lesson plans and writing prompts for over 15 years, for students as young as the 6th grade to graduate students, I know, as does any teacher in any discipline, that any lesson can and ought to be used more than once. That is a given. It's almost like saying, the great thing about this car is you can drive it more than one time. It's a ridiculous bit of advice tagged on for no apparent reason. But let's think about the language and the context of the exercise and what is suspected of Lance Voss. The exercise can be used more than once. Another way to express that idea is that this exercise can be used serially. The second clause reads, with a different picture each time. In other words, this is a serial activity to be enacted with a different photograph each time. And by picture, we know that Voss means a different person each time. And that leads us to the next section that he has curiously titled Hints. This was a word and a section of the exercise that, frankly, I brushed over. But Gloria brought it up to me and pumped the brakes during one of our calls.
Why would you call it, first of all, hints? That seems kind of an odd choice of words.
I would have to look back at other submissions and see if that was like a thing in this publication. I don't think it was. I think you're right there. Hints.
Hints. Why would you use that word? And then you're going down. He's giving a list of basically what we should look for. He might take a picture of the place or what he has used, but he wants a picture of that person. That's going to give him the best fantasy.
I think Gloria's onto something here. Adding a hint section to an exercise isn't a common feature in Notes Plus. So this is Voss's doing. It's a choice. There isn't anything that follows the word hints that couldn't be easily folded into a single standalone paragraph, or frankly eliminated. Instead, we get three numbered hints followed by his enclosure, and I do think they are hints. And again, as Paul and I had discussed, not only does Lance emphasize people twice in that line, but there is that unsettling tone that comes at the end of the clause, "but people are easiest." But that phrase, "people are easiest," stands out to me for another reason. And it comes once again back to the most dangerous game. As General Zaroff is slowly unveiling to Rainsford his own true nature as a serial killer, and therefore revealing Rainsford's captivity as unwitting prey or a pupil or student of the island, Zaroff says, quote, "Here in my presence on this island, I hunt more dangerous game," end quote. The implication, of course, is that humans are the most dangerous prey, even for the greatest of hunters. but there's a way in which I can imagine Lance totally rebuffing that claim and sort of flexing his narcissism by implying that people are far from the most dangerous prey, because to him, according to his language, people are in fact the easiest. Now look, again, I'm aware of how much of a stretch that is, and that's something I get. But again, this is Voss himself. This is his language. This is Voss calling this particular clause a hint. So there is that. Finally, I would add here that I think that there is another hint in the lesson plan, but it isn't labeled as much, not overtly, and that is the inclusion of Charleston, not Clarkston, Washington. If the Lost Husky ad taught us anything, it is whenever there is an oddity, or gratuitousness, as Jason would have it, in Lance's writing, and we wonder if it was editorial or accidental or intentional on his part, I think we've come to see that it is far more often the latter rather than the former instances. True, it is possible that this was an editorial mistake on behalf of the Notes Plus editors, but my gut tells me, from spending decades around and identifying with English majors, professors, teachers, and word nerds of all stripes, these kinds of mistakes are exceedingly rare. Of course, they still happen, but again, it's rare. That said, if Voss did submit the word Charleston on purpose, I doubt the editors in pre-internet days would have whipped out a Rand McNally atlas to fact-check Charleston, Washington as being a real town, especially given that they were headquartered in Urbana, Illinois, a couple hours south of Chicago. So, in the spirit of considering everything as a potential hint or clue until we exhaust the possibilities of it being a clue, I dove into this oddity. The first thing I noticed is that both Charleston and Washington have exactly the same number of letters, 10, whereas Clarkston only has 9. So perhaps the numerical symmetry of letters between the two words could be suggestive. Maybe. So I got a sheet of paper out and an array of colored pens. On the sheet of paper, I wrote Charleston and Washington. This is what I observed. Between the two words, there are two unique vowels, I and E. There are two repeated vowels, A and O, each recurring twice, as in A-A-O-O. There are 5 unique consonants, C-W-R-L-G. And there are 4 repeat consonants, S-H-N-T, with S-H and T occurring twice each, and N occurring 3 times. Looking at those letters, it's easy enough to pull out Christina White, for instance, but you have to use the unique vowel I 3 times to get there. Of course, you still can get White. So I kept moving letters around, trying to find words or phrases I could tease out that 1, used every letter in both words, and 2, only used each letter once. Now, of course, these are just arbitrary rules that I made up, but I started with said rules as a baseline, just to see if I could find a way in that could make some sense. Words that easily pop are words like what and shine and lashing and trashing, etc. So you can see that with 4 vowels and 9 consonants, there are likely innumerable possibilities. But the one that came to me fastest, with my arbitrary rules of using every letter in both words and only using each letter once, I came up with the following. Watching losers. And if you insert that into the enclosure under hints in the exercise, it would literally read Lance Voss watching losers. I mean, I could see how a narcissist who might be guilty of heinous crimes might use that kind of encoded taunt in a relatively niche venue as a form of covert duping delight, but I can also see that as just me noodling around with letters that mean exactly nothing. But let's say, for sake of argument, that there is something to what I quote-quote found. Even with that so-called solution watching losers, there are letters left over. So I tried other combinations. Words that I came up with include, but aren't limited to, clothes and clothing, and carnal, genitals, stoning, stone, water, trash, cleaning, show, tune, Nelson, Anino, lagoon, long, and so many more. Phrases I came up with include, but aren't limited to, was clothing torn, and she wasn't long in hot car, and has thrown stone, and I row canoes. Ultimately, I don't have time to invest in this kind of word search, not now anyway, but it's something for us to think about. If you find anything, please reach out to us. For now, however, I want to come back to my primary thesis.
When we are looking at any of Lance's writing and something seems weird, off, quirky, or gratuitous, I believe that there is an 85 to 90% chance that it is not arbitrary, that it is strategic, calculated, tactical, and taunting. It is very likely Lance Voss in the throes of his duping delight, in a full fit of psychopathic fantasy. And if this so-called lesson plan tells me anything, it's this. We're getting closer and closer to the truth. The Snake River Killer is a production of Resuscitate Media, LLC. I'm the host, Brandon Schrand. Original music is written and performed by the Young Night Drifters. Special thanks to Blake Walker, our engineer. Associate producers and investigators Gloria Boberts and Paul Dale. Graphic designer and content contributor Samantha Sawyer. Research consultant and criminologist Dr. Marianne White. And research assistant Tina Landry Oddie. Special thanks to Jennifer Anderson and Vernon Lott for letting us air portions of their documentary, Confluence. Be sure to check us out online where you can subscribe to the show and find resources, photos, timelines, articles, links, and more. Next time on The Snake River Killer. Some Googling turned up information on the Red Wolf Bridge, and listeners will remember that this is the bridge spanning the Snake River. The bridge was built in 1979. That was the year, of course, that Christina White went missing. Is it possible that the bridge was under construction when Christina White went missing?
We're semantics guys, but abandoned, vacant. Sometimes people use those words interchangeably, so it may have been more of a vacant home that was a known vacant residence. And somewhere in translation, it became an abandoned home.
Offenders tend to commit crimes where they're more comfortable and more familiar with the area. So by mapping out the crimes, you can kind of predict where the offender may either live or work.
Well, I have three main ideas. One, I'm a connector. I'm all about gathering as much information as we can and drawing lines between points of connection. You know, whether it's vacant houses or water or the mention of porches, verandas, and rundown decks. I'm all about how many of those connections can we make. Secondly, I don't think there's any harm in talking about cases that haven't been solved, because there's always a chance that we may stumble upon and solve a case that wasn't part of the original packet of cases we were looking at. That kind of thing happens. People have been out looking for bodies and found the body of someone they weren't looking for. Three, I think we're learners. And I think that while we might limit the focus that we report on, I don't think that we should limit our research.
I've created these maps, and it shows victims in the Bay Area versus where he worked, where he lived, his acquaintances. And then I created another one that was routes and where he traveled during certain years and where victims were.